Once in a while, an exceptional book comes along, and George Marsden's Jonathan Edwards is such a book. I think there was a copy or two out in the narthex. I know that it's expensive. It's published by Yale. All their publications are expensive, but they're not as expensive as some university publications. And they are the publishing house that's responsible for publishing and reissuing Jonathan Edwards' works in a modern, updated form. Those volumes are very expensive, too. I think many of them are approaching $100 a volume. So I'll be sure to remember to take that with me. I haven't got all the way through it, but most of it I have. And I don't think I've read a more judicious treatment of Edwards. And I like it because it is not always sympathetic. You know, we have our own saints, and we can find no fault in them. Sometimes we are being unfaithful to our doctrine of the fall. We're all fallen. And at the same time, Calvin and Edwards would say that in one sense, due to the grace of Christ, we also are all saints. Well, where to begin? Let me see if I can tie this together in this homespun way. Abraham beget Moses, and Moses beget David. And David became the ancestor of Jesus after the flesh. And Jesus beget Paul, and Paul beget Augustine or Augustine. And Augustine beget Calvin. And Calvin became the progenitor of Jonathan Edwards. Before Jonathan Edwards was born, a great darkness had settled over New England. And when God said, "Let Edwards be," the darkness was dispelled and all was light. Edwards is the theme of this lecture. He is a favorite of mine. As a matter of fact, in the order of my favorites, I would have to say that he comes maybe third on the list behind Augustine and Anselm, Luther and Calvin and Edwards are my favorite theologians in church history. Edwards was a Calvinist, but he didn't necessarily like to be called a Calvinist because he thought that denominated him a follower of a man from time to time, and it meant that he had to adopt, or it insinuated at least, that he adopted everything that Calvin said. And so he says if it meant that, then he didn't want to be called a Calvinist, but obviously he was a Calvinist. And he read carefully the writings of John Calvin. Let me just simply talk a little bit about his beginnings. I think the human side of all of these theologians are important. It not only lets us see something of their humanity, but it also lets us see something of those factors of their life and those people in their life that shaped and molded them. I think it's in Twelfth Night where Shakespeare, through one of the characters, says that some men are born great, some people become great, and some have greatness thrust upon them. Jonathan Edwards is one of those figures who was born very gifted. He also employed his gifts and trained them and honed his skills, and he became great. But also, due to the situation in which he lived in history, he also had greatness thrust upon him. He was born in East Windsor, Connecticut. His father, Timothy was a congregational minister. His mother, Esther Stoddard Edwards, the daughter of the Pope of Western Massachusetts, Solomon Stoddard, was his grandfather, and mother was a wonderful woman. She was dignified, that is, his mother. She was a tall and slender woman with a commanding presence. She outlived her husband and her son. Edwards grew up in a world of women. He had four older sisters and six younger. They, too, all were tall and slender. Timothy, the father, called his daughters 65 feet of daughters. The older sisters helped raise him, and he was doted upon, as Augustine was doted upon. Listen, if you dote upon your boys, I can say that in my observation of these people, they will be spoiled, but they may be great. Jonathan grew up himself to be over 6 feet tall, slender. He was always abstemious in his habits. A few facts about Edwards. First of all, he grew up British. The colonial period in American life, even as close to the American Revolution as Edwards lived, it was a British world. They thought as British citizens, and they took their life and their tea in the fashion of the British. They lived in a dangerous world, and make no mistake about this, the frontier-shaped Edwards all around were marauding Indians. It was clear that your life could be in danger if you wandered too far away. There were a number of Indian raids in the area. Some of his relatives were even carried off. It's also true that there was psychosis in his family, and Edwards himself may have inherited some depression. Jonathan, as a student, was very studious from the beginning. It was obvious that he was gifted just in the same way that the gifts of Calvin and Augustine were observed early on. It was clear that Jonathan Edwards was a gifted young man intellectually. He was interested in all types of knowledge, whether it was in nature or whether it was in concepts or beauty. He read philosophy, even difficult philosophy, at a very early age. And he went off to college at Yale. When he went off to college at Yale, he was already very well educated. All of his life, he was interested in what is called natural philosophy, which today we would call science. He read Newton, and he read others. Newton and Edwards may very well have been working on the book of Revelation at the same time, checking out its numbers. I don't have time to go into that, but it is intriguing to think that two of the greatest minds, in a short space apart, separated, of course, by a body of water, an ocean, nevertheless were working on the same book at the same time and interested in some of the same numbers. He believed that all truth is God's truth. He believed that there was a book of nature, and it was God's book, and a book of redemption, and that was God's book, that was the Bible. The book of Revelation, well, it was for him an interesting book simply because it was foretelling the things that were soon to come. He had by this time grown into the idea of a post-millennial view of life, and he was looking for signs. He was looking for anything that would tell him of the future coming in a mighty way of the presence of Christ. He believed that God was immediate in all situations in life. He was a person who had imbibed a great deal of philosophy, and he had come to certain philosophical conclusions. Number one, he was a philosophical idealist. That meant that he thought that the entire phenomenal world that you and I live in was an extension of the mind, the idea of God. It was in God's mind. Secondly, and this is important for his preaching, particularly if you read maybe not his best sermon by any stretch of the imagination, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, You can appreciate the power of that sermon if you understand that philosophically he believes that if God, since everything was in the mind of God, if God were to relax his mind about anything, it would lapse into nothingness. He was a philosophical occasionalist. And so that, in a real sense, enabled him to depict these scenes of hell and the tenuousness of life in a very vivid language. Let's look at his personality for a moment. I do think his personality and his habits were very important. He was a serious person. Even when he went off to Yale and he became a monitor of sorts over some other students, he was very conscientious and serious, and it didn't make him very likable to his contemporaries. However, he forced himself to be sociable. He was uncomfortable around social settings, except when talking about important matters. He always wanted to talk about serious things. He couldn't just simply get together and talk about life things. He was very, very pious in his life. He kept diaries from a young age, and he recorded his thoughts, his habits, his ways, his rebellions, his love for God, the beauty of nature. It's a vast diary system and notation system that he kept. He was strict and disciplined all of his life. He was always concerned from a very early age about his own conversion and religious experience, as he was, maybe to a fault, about the conversion and religious experiences of other people. Needless to say, his peers did not like him for that. But he also was aware of his intellectual prowess. He was aware that he had been gifted by God, and that he would engage and involve himself in the life of the intellect, and he did in his life. As I say, he was prone to depression. He had headaches, and he had bouts of poor health that in some cases made him alter his place or position in life due to the fact that he had poor health. He had a tremendous love for nature. The first time I encountered Jonathan Edwards was in a literature class as a sophomore in high school when I was not a Christian, but I knew what a Christian was. My parents were very and are very fine Christians. So I knew what a Christian was. And I can remember that we were in this lecture class, this large class, maybe 100, 150 students, and we were being lectured to, and we were reading Jonathan Edwards and some of his meditations. It was part of the anthology of the book. Every person in that classroom agreed that this man not only had God on the brain, but it was so unhealthy that surely he was mad already. But the thing is, as I go back and read him now, I simply see a person who's extraordinarily excited about nature. It's the book of God. It's God's arena. God is there. God created everything. And in one sense, he is truly in the language of one great philosopher, the God-intoxicated man. Well, Jonathan Edwards also got married to a wonderful woman, Sarah Pierpoint. And he admits that he got married because he was having some sexual temptation. It's hard to imagine that he would, but he did, and he admits it. And he was engaged at 15, and he married at 17. The woman, that is. She was 15, and they married at 17, and he was 24. It was a great marriage. They were the best of friends. Could not have been greater companions. And it was freeing to him. What kind of pastor was he? Well, he was a pastor. He certainly was a pastor. And I must say, after I have looked at his life a little bit, and I'm going to disappoint some of you by saying he probably wasn't the best pastor in the world. First of all, he studied 13 hours a day. He expected a great deal out of every person in the congregation in the way of holiness. He was sympathetic and tried to be sociable and understanding, but those things make it difficult for you to relate particularly to the weaknesses of some people, though he tried. He went to school for theological studies. He pastored in New York City in a place. He pastored in Bolton, close by. And, of course, he ended up finally in Northampton at Solomon Stoddard's church, father of his wife. He rose at 4 or 5 every morning, winter and summer alike. And he went to his study, and he did spend the 13 hours there. By the time he had finished his tenure at Northampton due to his writings, and there was a great deal of communication between America and Scotland and England, lots of communications going back and forth, and they were aware over there of who Jonathan Edwards was, and he had a wide reading audience in Great Britain, as well as some of them here. What is interesting about him is that he eventually lost the power struggle in the church, and he finds himself now on the frontier in western Massachusetts. Why did he have to leave the church? Well, it was a dispute over some of his relatives and their marriage that he didn't approve of. He saw some creeping Arminianism within the church, and he was right. He also, due to his strictness, was not very much appreciated. This was simply a dismissal as a result of a power struggle. He ended up in Stockbridge ministering to the Indians. And while he was there providentially, he simply mainly wrote and had the time to write. There he wrote The Freedom of the Will and, of course, his great work on original sin. Let me talk a little bit about his writings then, just briefly, before I talk a little more about religious affections and put it in context. The Freedom of the Will, Paul Ramsey, who taught at Princeton University and later at Drew University, Paul Ramsey, the great Methodist ethicist and theologian, says that if he had produced no other work, this work alone shows the signs of genius. And it is the first work I read of Jonathan Edwards. It is a great work. Again, it's not necessarily easy going, but it is something that you can get through and everyone can read it with profit. One of the things that you'll notice there that the title of his work, The Freedom of the Will, is in fact in some ways 180 degrees out of phase with the title of Martin Luther's same work on the bondage of the will. And what is interesting, that regardless of the two distinct titles and what they might insinuate, Luther and Edwards did not disagree with respect to the capacity of the will and its nature to choose and what it could choose. Here essentially is what Jonathan Edwards was saying, as far as I can understand, in the Freedom of the Will. Jonathan Edwards understood that you had a faculty of choosing. Now, that faculty of choosing, of course, would always be greater than your capacity for knowledge. And even if you had no defective fallen nature, you still would make wrong choices and displease God because your capacity to choose was greater than your capacity for knowledge. Now, he does take that up, and that accounts for one reason for the fact that there is evil in the world, there's sin, and there's wickedness. But he was much more profound in his discussion about the will. And he says the will itself, though, conforms to the nature of what it means to be human. And since we are fallen, the will itself has been corrupted and will always choose in its own interest. Now, here's the interesting thing. He says that you are not compelled to make choices. God is not there forcing you into this choice or that choice. He says, as a matter of fact, your will is free and it will always choose what it wants to do most. Now think about that. You will always do what you want to do most. You will always do what your nature wants you to do. Now you say, well, you can't believe what a struggle I had over this. I struggled over this, I struggled over this, and for weeks I had no idea which way I would turn or go or what I would do. Jonathan Edwards would say, yes, sure, sometimes you only want to do something slightly more than you don't want to do it. But still, you always do what you want to do most. And in that sense, your will is free to conform to your fallen nature. And it's a great book, and it's a good book simply from the standpoint of understanding the way we think and the way we work. His second great work, everyone agrees, is Religious Affections. Religious Affections. Before I tackle Religious Affections, let me simply talk about the revivalistic tradition within New England and New England Puritanism, actually leading up, in one sense, to the present. The Puritan, quote, revolution was born out of revival. It was born out of revival in England, and in America it continued that revival. They meant to be a new people, a people with an errand into the wilderness to be finally a society set on a hill, a city, to be an example to the nations. And New England Puritanism from 1621 was characterized by a series of revivals. But there came a time, as Perry Miller says, when the children and the grandchildren of the Puritans were unable to keep up with the pace at which they heard the drums. The drum beat was too fast, and they fell by the wayside. And Puritanism really split by the time we get into the 18th century. It split into a kind of cool, collected, reasonable expression of religion that you find in and around of Boston. But in some quarters, it continued into its revivalistic spirit and condition. Solomon Stoddard, for instance, in central Massachusetts, not far from here, surely, and up and down the Connecticut Valley, there was revival. Solomon Stoddard had talked about having 5 harvests in his ministry during the time he was there. And when Jonathan Edwards came to succeed his father-in-law in Northampton, he too experienced some real revival there. As a matter of fact, many people believe that the first stirrings and seeds of the Great Awakening began in the ministry of Jonathan Edwards. Others will claim that it was in the ministry of a Dutchman by the name of Frelinghuysen in New Jersey. Nevertheless, Edwards was part of the revivalistic movement. And there have been, as sociologists point out, 4 Great Awakenings in America. Now, a Great Awakening is to be distinguished from an ordinary awakening or a revival because of the extent and duration of the revival. It's great because it's extended and it happens over a period of time. And sociologists have identified at least 4 in our history. The first was the Great Awakening under Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield and the Frelinghuysens and others. And this is a significant awakening because many will say that people on these shores became consciously a separate nation through this revival. It changed their minds and the way they looked at themselves. They began to look themselves at more as Americans and less as British. And the British saw that too. They were actually calling the people here who were British citizens, they were calling them Americans before we called ourselves Americans. The second Great Awakening was the Great Awakening that happened much after Edwards and beginning into the 19th century. And this is late 18th, early 19th century, when a lot of colleges and universities were established in this country. And it was a tremendous revival that sent out many missionaries around the world. The third Great Awakening, scholars will say, was under Moody and Stanky and others like them in the late 19th century here in America. And it helped settle the immigrant population into this country and to integrate them into public life. The fourth Great Awakening, by the way, is supposedly took place in the 60s and continues today. So if we are criticized by the Europeans and others around the world for being too religious, it is because they see that we have separated ourselves from the coolness and the distant approach to religion that Europe has, and they see us as being in some kind of revival mode. Take that for what it is. Edwards, in this context, wants to examine, and he writes a theology of revival and awakenings, and that's what Religious Affections is. It is really a theology to examine what great awakenings and revivals are all about. The title itself, again, is interesting. It is interesting because he titles it Religious Affections. And he has in mind the word affections to mean something like this. Affections for him equaled the fruit of the Spirit. That's what affections were. Religious affections in this case meant the fruit of the Spirit. Just simple affections were, of course, the kind of personality traits or whatever you may have. But true religious affections he equated essentially with the fruit of the Spirit in the Bible. Now, the fruit of the Spirit, of course, were necessary to demonstrate that the Spirit of God was indwelling your life, that you have the presence of the Holy Spirit of God, meaning you had Christ. If you truly had Christ, you had the Spirit, but the evidence of having the Spirit would be that you have the fruit of the Spirit. Now, his task for him in this work was to try to distinguish the work of the Spirit of God from a false work of the Spirit or just simply the work of a human spirit. And in religious affections, he has 12 tests or 12 signs to test the fruit of the Spirit or to try the spirits and see if they be of God or not. Now, why did he write this? Well, he wrote this not because he was interested in providing for us a demonstration of his prowess to tease out motivations to be able to distinguish one thing from another, though he could do all of that. He really was concerned about whether God was stirring in the human heart or not, or what was good about the Great Awakening under his ministry and others, and what was not good. First of all, he knew that in the Great Awakening, a lot of things that were taking place in the name of God, in the name of Christ, were not of the Spirit of God. He even warned George Whitefield to stay away from the fanatics. And Whitefield, of course, was not as sophisticated as Jonathan Edwards and so forth, and he was much more apt to buy into a lot of things that would have been an embarrassment to Jonathan Edwards. But really, he is writing the work Religious Affections also to address as a polemic against those, particularly in the Boston area, the Calvinists, the children of Calvinists who had now become Unitarian, had been affected greatly by the Enlightenment, and who were now mistaking morals and habits for religion. He called this general trend that he saw in New England Puritanism, he called it Arminianism, but it was simply a term to talk about the rise of Unitarianism within Puritan New England theology. And it was among these that were denigrating the idea that there was any such thing as a true stirring and revival of the people of God, a great and general awakening. And secondly, for them, just simply being moral and civic was enough. God was pleased with that. And so Edwards wrote this work to address two points. To defend the revival movement and the Great Awakening as being a true movement of the Spirit of God in the lives of people. And secondly, also to warn against the excesses and the enthusiasms that you could see as part of the Great Awakening as well. Now, Edwards was quite convinced of this when he wrote Religious Affections, that probably you cannot have true spiritual revival without excesses. That true spirit of the movement of God would in fact be accompanied by false movements of spirits that were inimical to the work and program of God and hostile to the gospel. Let me talk about one other thing too about religious affections that I wish to mention. Edwards was quite a theologian. He was in some sense much more theological than John Calvin. You would have to go back to Augustine to be able to see someone who had a significant program to produce theologies in the same way that Edwards did. He was highly theological. We might say John Calvin was simply a biblical theologian. Jonathan Edwards not only was a biblical theologian, but he was indeed a theologian and a philosophical theologian as well. Edwards, though, you can see his Calvinism working in him at every step. There are certain things that he presupposed in life that he inherited from his Calvinist forebears, and that, of course, was in election and predestination. He took them to be true without question much, except at one point when he was at Yale, and he had settled his theology for life when he was at Yale. Secondly, when it comes to his theology, he certainly understood the Ordo Salutis, that is, the order of salvation, in the same way that Calvin did. He knew that always that grace comes before faith. And in every Calvinist theology, grace will always precede faith. It can't be otherwise. And so we cannot save ourselves. God must indeed, through grace alone, save us. But when we come to faith and trust in Christ, which is God's gift, as he understood clearly, sometimes he would call it an intuition, a presence of God, and we learn to trust God, then likewise we are united with God in Christ. We're united with Christ. It's our union with Christ. And out of this union, in the same way that you find in the theology of Calvin, flow our justification and our sanctification. They were agreed on that point. So when we talk about the theology of Jonathan Edwards, it was full, it was robust, it was Calvinistic, but it was his own because he was truly an original thinker. When we come to religious affections, we see a great theological mind at work on a very important problem for New England. Now, what was the immediate impact of his work? Well, Charles Chauncey and Jonathan Mayhew, clergy liberals who were very prominent in their day, rejected what he had to say. The children of the Puritans in New England, I'm not speaking about Jonathan Edwards' children, but the children of Mayhew and Chauncey also rejected Jonathan Edwards. I'm going to close this with the reading in part of Oliver Wendell Holmes' The Deacon's Masterpiece, but we'll get there in due time and soon. But Jonathan Edwards' legacy, interesting enough, was mixed following his death. He had an untimely death. He was asked to be the president of the Log College of New Jersey. Anyone know what that college is? Princeton. And being a progressive and being a lover of science, he was first in line to take a smallpox vaccination. It did not go well with him, and 3 months later, after taking the office of presidency of the Log College of New Jersey, he died at about the same age as John Calvin when he died. But what was his reputation? Well, all through the 19th century, he hovered over New England. You could see his spirit hovering all of New England and a lot of American theological thinkers. They are aware of Jonathan Edwards. His reputation in the late 19th century and early 20th century, it is interesting to say the least. His Calvinism over that period of time grew out of favor. Some people even feared and despised him in the 19th and early 20th century. I want you to hear the judgment of Mark Twain about Jonathan Edwards. He said, "A resplendent intellect gone mad." A resplendent intellect gone mad. That was essentially the reputation that Jonathan Edwards ended up with in the 19th century. Something happened, though, in the course of the early 20th century. A.C. McGifford wrote a biography of Jonathan Edwards, and some others began to take interest in Jonathan Edwards. And by the middle of this past century, Jonathan Edwards had been fully resurrected in many quarters, and he was appreciated for his labors and for his genius. It probably, though, was not fully understood as to his true genius until the 20th century. Perry Miller, his greatest biographer, who was Jewish and an atheist, wrote about Jonathan Edwards, and he said this: a genius, a modern man who simply employed Calvinistic categories to explain his view of the world. It is because of the labors of Perry Miller and others that Yale began to publish all of his works. H. Richard Niebuhr, whom I think it was a great thinker, an important thinker in the early part of the last century, championed Edwards' theology even when he was not evangelical. But he taught a whole generation of people the distinction between liberalism, a theology of liberalism, and traditional orthodox theology. And people like Miller and Niebuhr, when they were not evangelical, could clearly see that there was something profound in Edwards and not in his contemporary critics. H. Richard Niebuhr once defined a liberalism or liberal theology or the tradition of Mayhew and others in this way. He says, their theology was this: a God without wrath brought men without sin into a kingdom without judgment through the ministrations of a Christ without a cross. Edwards countered that at every point. He wrote on the atonement. He wrote on original sin. He wrote great works and sermons on redemption, on eschatology. And Edwards is read today. Many of you may not have ever heard of Chauncey and Mayhew. Jonathan Edwards is read today in ways that no one could ever suspect it in the 19th century. It's interesting that over 300 doctoral dissertations have been done on Jonathan Edwards in major American universities. Think of that. Over 300 dissertations have been done on this man. Today, Jonathan Edwards, by the way, in the scholarly world, he happens to provide alone enough work that we can say that he himself is an industry. In all, you need to know the motivation of this man. He had one motivation in life. It is clear. It's more clear almost than anyone you can ever find. It's the same motivation that Johann Sebastian Bach had. He wrote, he said, everything to the glory of God. I'd like to close with this poem. It's a little long. I don't know whether I can read it. I probably won't read all of it. The Deacon's Masterpiece. How many of you heard it? Have you ever heard of The Deacon's Masterpiece? The Deacon's Masterpiece, or The Wonderful One Hoss Shay, A Logical Story by Oliver Wendell Holmes. Listen to it. Have you heard of the wonderful one hoss shay that was built in such a logical way? It ran 100 years to a day, and then all of a sudden it all but stay. I'll tell you what happened without delay. Scaring the parson into fits, frightening people out of their wits. Have you ever heard of that, I say? 1755, Georgius Segundus was then alive. Snuffy old drone from the German hive. That was the year when Lisbon town saw the earth open up and gulp her down, and Braddock's army was done so brown, left without a scalp to its crown. It was on the terrible earthquake day that the deacon finished his one hoss shay. Now, in building a chassis, I tell you what, there is always somewhere a weakest spot. In hub, tire, fellow, in spring or thrill, in panel or crossbar or floor or still, in screw, bolt, thorough brace, lurking still, find it somewhere you must and will, above or below or within or without, and that's the reason beyond a doubt that a chassis breaks down but doesn't wear out. But the deacon swore, as deacons do, with an "I do vum and I'll tell you," he would build one shay to beat the town and the country and the county around. It should be so built that it couldn't break down. "For," said the deacon, "'tis mighty plain that the weakest places must stand the strain. Now, the way to fix them is, I maintain, is only just to make that place as strong that's supposed to be the weak as the rest." So the deacon inquired of the village folk where he could find the strongest oak that couldn't be split or bent nor broke. That was for spokes and floor and sills, he sent for lancewood to make the thrills. The crossbars were ash from the straightest trees, the panels of white wood that cuts like cheese. But lasts like iron for things like these, the hubs of logs from the settler's elm, last of its timber, they couldn't sell 'em. Never an axe had seen their chips, and the wedges flew from beneath their lips. Their blunt ends fizzled like celery tips. Step and prop iron, bolt and screw, spring, tire, axle, and linchpin too. Steel of the finest, bright and blue, thoroughbrace, bison skin, thick and wide, boot top, dasher from the tough old hide, found in the pit when the tanner died. That was the way he put her through. "There," said the deacon, "now she'll do. Do I tell you, I rather guess she was a wonder and nothing less. Colts grew horses, beards turned gray, deacons and deaconesses dropped away, children and grandchildren, where were they? But there stood the stout old one-horse shay, as fresh as on Lisbon earthquake day. 1800, it came and found the deacon's masterpiece strong and sound. 1800 increased by 10, Hasham carriage, they called it then. Handsome carriage, I should say, they called it then. 1820 came, running as usual, much the same. 30 and 40 at last arrived, and then came 50 and 55. Little of all we value here wakes on the morn of its 100th year without both feeling and looking queer. In fact, there's nothing that keeps its use, so far as I know, but a tree and truth. This is a moral that runs at large. Take it. You're welcome. No extra charge. 1st of November, the earthquake day. There are traces of age in the one-horse shay, a general flavor of mild decay, but nothing local, as one may say. There couldn't be, for the deacon's art had made it so like in every part that there wasn't a chance for one to start. For the wheels were just as strong as the thrills, and the floor was just as strong as the sills, and the panels just as strong as the floor, and the whipple tree neither less nor more, and the back crossbar as strong as the fore, and spring and axle and hub encore. And yet, as a whole, it is past a doubt, in another hour it will be worn out. 1st of November, 55, this morning the parson takes a drive. Now, small boys, get out of the way. Here comes the wonderful one-horse shay, drawn by a rat-railed, ewe-necked bay. Hut up, said the parson, and off they went. The parson was working his Sunday text. He got to 50th. I won't preach 50th point. And stopped perplexed at that. What the Moses was coming next? All at once the horse stood still, close by the meeting house on the hill. First a shiver and then a thrill. Then something decidedly like a spill. And the parson was sitting upon a rock at 9:30 by the meeting house clock. Just the hour of the earthquake shook. What do you think the parson found when he got up and stared around? The poor old chassis in a heap or a mound, as if it had been to the mill and ground. You see, of course, if you're not a dunce, how it went to pieces all at once. All at once, and nothing first, just as bubbles do when they burst. Into the wonderful one-horse shay. Logic is logic. That's all I say. Oliver Wendell Holmes, he thought in his day that the influence and theology of Jonathan Edwards had ended forever in New England. The logical one-horse shay built by the deacon was Edwards' legacy in theology. It was over. It just lasted 100 years. Let me say, more people read Jonathan Edwards today than ever read Oliver Wendell Holmes. More people read Jonathan Edwards today than read Jonathan Mayhew or William Chauncey. More people read Jonathan Edwards today in the English-speaking world than almost any other theologian that has lived in the past 300 years. His influence, like Calvin's and like Augustine, continues to fashion and shape the minds of many, many among us. Praise be to God. Amen.